listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
Hello everyone, I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Howard Wallace.
And this week Howard and I are going to be focusing on 1 Samuel 15 verses 34 to chapter 16 verses 13. We might have a brief reference to Psalm 20 and then spend time on the Gospel Mark 4 verses 26 to 34. And it's the fourth week after Pentecost.
Yes.
I forgot to say that at the beginning. So Howard, I think it would be good to have a little bit of background in the first book of Samuel for people who mightn't have come to it, you know, for a while.
Right. And that's important, I think, because this particular episode in today's readings really is important in David's movement towards becoming a king. So it's a significant chapter or section. First Samuel began by talking about the prophet, we might call him a prophet, Samuel himself, and his election to the role that he took. But it appears by the time we sort of move through a few chapters that Samuel is not going to have any succession. His sons are corrupt and aren't worthy of the high priesthood, and the Philistines have become a military threat to them. And so the whole question of military conquest by the Philistines is real. The corruption within the Israelites, call them that for the moment, is real too. And so begins a debate over kingship and whether Israel should have a king, and it's often termed as a king like the nations, which means something more than what they get in Saul, the first king. That debate goes on from chapters 8 through to chapter 12. And then we have Saul elected as the first king. He's not a king really like the nations. He's little more than a tribal leader who takes on from time to time the tasks that are set, the issues that confront the people. So it's a limited kingship, and his struggle against the Philistines is, in chapters 13 and 14, is ineffectual in the end.
Right. When you say like the nations, are you talking about inherited kingship there?
Well,
or
partly inherited kingship, but with a whole sort of social structure that builds around that of a hierarchical sort of society where the king is head priest, head military leader, head administrator, and it flows down through that to, I mean, more or less a feudal sort of system.
Right, okay.
So that's the issue. That's what happens in the end with Solomon. Not quite with David, almost there, but certainly Saul was far from that sort of model. And it's in, and here, as I said, his kingship is ineffectual in the end in a number of ways. But he also displeases the Lord in this process.
Yes, because he doesn't go far enough in the Lord's mind, is that correct, in some of the more violent aspects?
Yes, and one particular episode is that when Israel came into the land, or were about to come into the land, they were opposed by people called the Amalekites, who live on the other side of the Jordan Rift Valley from the Philistines, in other words, over in the east. They opposed Israel. And the Lord seems to have always had it against them for that very reason. And Saul was told that he had to
annihilate them.
Annihilate them. Well, he battled and he beat them, but the trouble is he kept some of the spoil for himself. And he made up this sort of story that he was keeping it in order to sacrifice the various animals.
They were animals.
Yes, mostly. For the Lord. This was his tale, and it's important actually for the story today as it comes back in. In the end, the Lord rejects Saul totally and sends Samuel on this mission to find a new king whom the Lord has obviously already chosen, but Samuel is somewhat in the dark in this process. He's also perplexed because he knows, well, he's grieving for Saul. He really hasn't affection of some sort for Saul. But on the other hand, he knows that if Saul finds out what he's up to, what he's being sent to do, his own life would be in danger. So he's got this sort of
There's a lot of political intrigue.
There is.
Here.
And that's one thing I think we need to be aware of in this. This is a story that is created. We're not reading history here. And I think by saying it's a story, what I mean is that we've really got to get into the skin of the characters in the narrative and to understand what's going on and what's happening.
And that would, I mean, if we may, that character, that one of those characters is Yahweh.
Yes, here, it is God.
Who we're told in verse 35 regretted that he'd made Saul a king.
Yes.
And my understanding is that there's only one other occasion where Yahweh regrets something, which is bringing the flood.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the Noah story.
Yes.
So, I mean, that's significant.
So God can change his mind.
God can change his mind.
According to the text. Yeah.
And then, yes. And maybe theologically we might say that in that sense, David, as the flood was brought something new, a newness, like that, so does David.
Yes.
And as we know, and in the text we'll find out, that's not entirely a marvellous thing.
No. I mean, one of the other things we need to keep in mind is this is also a bit of propaganda literature. It really is a way of justifying David as king. And most kings in the ancient Near East and Egypt elsewhere in that world really were busy about justifying their own sort of ascendancy to the throne.
Yeah. I mean, in that point you can even see in a word count statistic that the name of David is mentioned over 1,000 times in the Hebrew scriptures and about 60 times in the New Testament. So, yeah.
Yes.
Strong propaganda, given the abuses of power and failings.
Yes, we've got to remember his darker side.
Yeah.
At times too, although he did, well, he's recalled as having done a lot of good.
And just we will elaborate on this bit in the next reading, but that the language of the theological, that kingship became sort of a theological vehicle.
Yes.
To talk about.
Yes, I mean
God and God's Son and the Messiah, etc.
Yes. So. And even the way God acts towards kingship. I mean, he's in those chapters 8 to 12, I mean, God is reluctantly sort of ceding to the people's request or some of the people's request.
Yes.
Anyway, Samuel's off to find
his task,
the new king. But because he's nervous about Saul's, if Saul hears about it, what he might do, the Lord gives him sort of a ruse. And that is that he's being sent to Jesse, David's father, and he will review the likely royal nature of all of Jesse's sons in due course. But in order to sort of disguise this activity from Saul, the Lord tells him that to tell others that he's going there to sacrifice, a special sacrifice with Jesse, which is the irony of the story, you see, because Saul himself has displeased God because he did not annihilate the Amalekites, but then had his own story about how he was going to sacrifice the
animal
he kept for himself. So we've got a lie on the one hand by Saul and then this ruse by the Lord through Samuel, which are all playing off each other. They're both about sacrifice in this context. So you bring the two together. But it raises an interesting question. How do you distinguish the lie of the thief, Saul, from the ruse of the Lord's servant, Samuel, and his sacrifice, when they're in the midst of a turmoil, and Samuel himself at this stage still doesn't know whom the Lord has chosen. So it's a difficult situation for
him. It is, and like, how do you discern? I'm not going to respond to you providing a way one would discern, surprisingly not. I will respond by saying what that tells me, that ambiguity placed before us in the text, is that we need to be quite humble in the face of our own assumptions about whether who we think is bad or good or telling the truth or not. And because we love to draw legal lines around who fits in and out and who's good enough and so on. So for me in the story, that's the point.
Yes, and I think it's also inviting us to the sense of sometimes we just don't know the outcome of things. This will also come up, I think, in Mark to some extent. And, you know, we're just invited to proceed, I think, as faithfully as we we can, without necessarily having the assurance that we're on the right track.
For me, the flip side of that too is God works God's ways whether we have judges or kings. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, God is displeased about our, I use our as in humans, desire for a king. And in a sense, that request from Israel is a rejection of what God had going for them in the first place, which God has patiently accepted by saying, yeah, you can have a king. But as we've alluded, it doesn't, none of it's all rosy after they have kings.
No.
But, and yet far God, you know, far from it. Mm. And yet, but God works God's creative ways through these fallen people, individuals.
Yeah, I mean, there is an adaptability within God to the human sort of context, and God seems to be willing to bend a little if needed.
So, all right, I'll give you kings. It's not going to make a huge amount of difference, actually. It's not going to –
we'll
no,
work that way.
So, you know, then the question too is, well, what – theologically, what is the best form of rule? I just – there's a question for your sermon. I'm not saying this is going to give you the answer, but except the answer is maybe it doesn't matter up to a point.
Yes, but there's always sort of
you know,
you're going to try and strike trouble no matter
what system. And humans' ideas, our programs, and our idea of what will get things to utopia all right, are fallible.
Yes. But I think that leads us on then to, of course, to the whole point of the story, and that is Samuel sees the lineup of Jesse's sons one after the other, none of whom the Lord sort of is excited about, even though they're working from the eldest down.
Which is the normal course of
process, yes.
Inheritance of power or whatever.
One of them, the youngest out in the field, is still looking after the sheep.
Who they forget about. So I find an interesting inconsistency in the story, in the sense that God advises not to look on the surface for what God needs. But then when we are introduced to David, who's arrived from the field in verse 12, we're told quite clearly how he was glowing in health and very handsome. So
all the things that would recommend him as being a king. But, I mean, there's lots of other fact that he's out in the fields looking after the sheep. I mean, one of the titles of the kings of the, well, for Mesopotamia especially, is the great shepherd of the sheep. This image was right across the ancient Near East. So there's a whole lot of symbolism in this story that point to David as God's choice.
Which obviously then becomes a paradigmatic thing, way of talking about the Messiah and Jesus, the language used of
Jesus.
And
yet we're not to look on human standards and stuff. We've got to keep these things in balance.
Paradox again. So there's election, obviously, there's election here and the coming of the Spirit. So
that's the other thing we need to note too. Yes. I mean, the very last verse in the reading, it's set, talks about the Spirit coming on David, and the very first verse in the next bit, which probably might not hear, is now the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul. So there's this swapping over going on.
And so in the... So as humans, we want to say, well, who's good enough to be elected and chosen? When actually, if we look at the texts in the Bible in general, but the Hebrew scriptures in particular, it's about Yahweh's purpose. The focus is not the gifts of the person necessarily, but the purpose of God in calling them. And so, you know, even God choosing Israel because they were numerous and because he loved them. Not anything in them in as such, if you know what I mean.
And
the pattern of preferring younger sons over older ones through Genesis.
Yes.
You know.
Which runs through into into this
and
story
then,
quite clearly.
Clearly, as we've been saying, that spirit possession is the sign. I mean, it seems the Spirit is not present. The coming of the Spirit is the result of being chosen. Is the Spirit present before you're chosen? That's a question. In the text, it's not.
No.
And then when you're unchosen, it goes.
Yes.
So and the Spirit's only comes on Saul and David, is my in my understanding.
Saul, yes.
And then
yes.
after that,
you don't hear about, you don't it in hear terms about of Solomon. It.
No. What is that? Do you know? Have you got a comment to make about
no,
that?
No, not really. Not really. Okay. I think it sort of is very erratic when we
yeah
we talk about that, and you know we're talking about the breath of God really, in terms of the word itself.
Yeah, ruach. The creative work. Now we've got Psalm 20 set for yes. today. You had one clear comment.
I mean, when we read about it, it's about David is requesting the help of God in some sort of military conflict, which doesn't sound very nice in this sort of context. But I think, you know, if we put that psalm in the context of the book of Psalms, the context of the book of Psalms, it sort of makes a bit of sense. Because if you go back to two psalms, to Psalm 18, the heading on that psalm is about David praying for God's help when Saul is trying to kill him. Now, we haven't got quite to those episodes in the book of Samuel yet, but they will come up. But then this Psalm 20 begins sort of thing where Psalm 18 ends off, and I think the one of the verses that could become a point of repetition within a service for Sunday is verse 7. You know, some take pride in chariots and some in horses, but our pride is in the name of the Lord, which I think is picking up the theme that's in both Samuel's story and in Mark, which we'll come to now.
Mm. Yeah, so let's have a look now at Mark 4, verses 26 to 34. So the parable of the mustard seed and the growing seed in chapter 4, I think these two little parables need to be seen in contrast or alongside the beginning of chapter 4 with the parable of the seed going onto various soils. Mm. It's a very seed-laden
chapter. It's a very seedy
chapter.
Thing, yes. picking up on the use of growth within nature too, which is quite a strong biblical theme.
So Mark doesn't have heaps and heaps of parables like the other
quite a few
writers.
Of them come quite quickly at the beginning.
So that the early in chapter 4, the various soils, that's quite different. I mean, in a sense, what it's saying is almost opposite what's happening here. So in that one, there's this cavalier approach to the seed going everywhere and that it's actually not going to grow in certain spots. And it's perhaps a comment in Mark, you might ask, well, these disciples who don't understand anything are throwing this seed all over the place where they don't – I don't know, they could play with themes like that. Whereas here it's much more straightforward where – a man is a scattered seed on the ground and it grows. And this is interesting. I just want to make a quick connection with the Samuel reading just now that whatever this man does, he goes to sleep, he gets up. The seed's growing, a bit like whether we have judges or kings or what we do.
Things are happening.
Things are happening.
Without
our effort, frustration.
And, you know, the whole business of, I mean, people would sort of say, oh, we do know about the germination of seeds these days, don't we? But the point is not so much in, I think, in the detail of what we know or what we can interfere
no,
with.
No, and I would argue that the miraculousness of that is still with us. Well, that this innocuous looking thing, this dead looking thing, and we've, you know, when we were in primary school and we had those cotton wool on the windowsill and you'd put, I forget what the seeds were.
Wheat, maybe, initially.
And you can, the next morning you go to bed and the next morning you get up and it's got green. A little green bit in it. You know, there's, I mean, even though we might understand the process, it's still
it's
remarkable.
It's magical.
Yeah, magical.
That, in a way. And even the same with the mustard seed, which then gets onto the parallel with Samuel about the smallest, supposedly.
So I think a comment around parables per se is important in a sermon here, and you know that the parable is putting two things alongside each other to draw out a different thing.
Yes,
that's a bit general. Comparing two things and providing a contrast or an analogy. Creating a picture and upending our expectations and our values of how the world is ordered is what a parable is designed to do. Yeah. And I've done this a couple of times in this podcast over the years, but pointed to Ben Myers, who's a theologian and scholar in general, who wrote 10 rules for preaching parables on his old website, Faith and Theology. They were quite funny and really important, things like don't assume you're the goodie and they're the baddies kind of thing, which is not so pertinent in this particular parable. But he's got another rule is if you don't mention the kingdom of God in preaching it, then you're doing it wrongly. And what number six seems of his rules seems most pertinent here, where he says, if Jesus seems more like a headmaster giving orders than a comedian cracking jokes, you're probably doing it wrong when you're preaching from parable. And these are quite, I mean, these are not laugh out loud funny to us, but there's a certain level of satire in the play going on here around the mustard bush, which is an incredibly unimpressive shrub. I don't think it's called a shrub in this translation of NRSV, though. But I understand it that word is used in some translations.
It is called a shrub in Mark, but apparently it becomes a tree in Matthew and Luke.
Interesting.
I think. But the other thing about parables themselves, and this is sort of picking up on the last verse about when it talks about him talking in many parables and not being understood, except trying to explain it to his disciples, that there's a sort of a mystery within the parable itself that is there within the two parables beforehand. You know, you don't know what's happening with the seed under the ground, and you don't know how the tiniest little thing becomes this great big bush. The parables themselves sort of fit in with that sort of teaching.
They are what they do.
Yes, and they work away
at us,
even if you don't quite understand.
Yeah, earlier in chapter four, I think he says, "I'm saying this so that those who see don't." Or those who don't perceive see, or something like that. Yeah. You can look it up, folks. Yeah. But like, there is a few verses in earlier in chapter four where the conundrum of the parable is actually explicitly stated.
Verse 10 and following.
Yeah. Verse 10 onwards.
Yes, but the other thing I think that's in about these parables, they're sort of biographical in terms of Jesus's own sort of life. He's going to die and rise again. So there's a sort of a hint of resurrection sort of theology through. And there are also paradigms for Christian sort of living. You know? Again, you know, we may not always understand what's going on in the world, but being faithful in that sort of context is important. And we can be, to some extent, sort of assured or have an optimism about the world that is not sort of governed or depressed by the pessimism that sort of just seems to be on the surface.
Yeah, I think that's a really important, especially these days. I think that's a really vital message. And also that the doing of the small thing is part of the resistance or part of the living defiantly into that hope. Right. You know, this mustard bush that's incredibly humble. And actually, I did read somewhere that that's a bit of a play on Ezekiel 17:23, which talks about a noble cedar with birds under it, that imagery is coming here and doing a different thing, a really different thing. Yeah. And that it's the other thing, it's a humble bush, but it's something like we would call ivy. It just gets into everything. And quite hard to eradicate. And that's a fantastically hopeful and subversive idea to play with around God's power in the world, that it's actually hard to eradicate. It is there and an unkillable, even though it doesn't look like it a lot of the time.
Yes. But also being aware that we're not responsible and we are not able to do all of this ourselves. We have to, I think, have faith that God is actually working there within the midst of all that.
Yeah, and that's the common theological message really through the Samuel and this one.
Mm.
So are there any last – there's a lot to be – we haven't gone close to the text so much here, really, have we?
There's not a lot of it.
No, there's not a lot of it. I'm just having a quick re-look to see if there's anything. So he didn't say anything to them without using a parable.
Mm.
How frustrating when you just want an answer.
Yeah.
So I think that's and then there's the element – we've touched on this, but the element – there's some sort of secret going on. But he then does explain everything to the disciples, who still don't get it through the Gospel of Mark. But
yes, because I think one of the things you've got to be careful of is that the last verse is not talking about sort of privileged knowledge to the elect few over against the ignorance of the whole or the rest. And that because once we sort of move beyond these couple of parables to Jesus stilling the storm and healing and doing other things – we suddenly start to learn that these disciples don't understand what's going on.
No.
Yeah. Even to the point where we get to the middle of the gospel and Peter's resisting Jesus'
denying completely.
Turn towards Jerusalem.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that probably wraps us up for this week. Thanks, Howard.
Okay. You're welcome.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.